again. I just wanted to let you know that the survey to which I referred a little while ago is not in your packet. I know you were all looking for it. But it's out actually on the tables out there. And so it's available in both French and English. So if you want to pick up a copy and think about the questions in advance of tomorrow's session, that would be great. Okay?
Well, welcome back. I hope you had a good health break and fired up and ready to go, as my brother down south says. We were able to get the blog up so that you can actually get a sense of some of the entries on it at the moment. And two core themes that I just want to comment on include the Shirk architecture. There was an earlier entry by Noreen, and then there's this one from the Canadian Economics Association. And then, of course, there are a number of, this whole week we've had up entries on mentoring. And as we speak, there are two very talented people, Karen and Ryan, live blogging at the back. And they have been doing that all morning, putting up Noreen's words of wisdom and Karen's and Christian's as well. Okay, well, if we get started, this plenary has been in the works for a year, and I want to, before I proceed, of course, give my heartfelt thanks to Alison Faulkner, with whom I was conceiving of this, to Pierre Normand, and of course to the executive for helping to put this all into place, and of course to the staff at the Federation. And behind all of that was Marie-Paul, who is one of my favorite gurus in the whole world. The plenary takes its name from a paper I drafted back in December on mentoring. The earlier title was called Beyond the Hype, Much Ado About Mentoring. And part of that was to try and get beyond all of the mentoring is all things good, to actually tackle some of the more thorny and tougher issues. So both, if you will, in the pros and cons of mentoring. So in that paper, and I'm not going to give it, but I looked at what mentoring is and isn't, and of course, for example, the differences between mentoring and coaching or mentoring and advising and so on. Secondly, the possibilities of mentoring, when, where, how mentoring can matter, and for undergraduate students, graduate student mentoring, postdoctoral fellows and new scholars, which has been a priority for the Federation for some time. And then an area that often gets overlooked, mentoring mid-career faculty. Those faculty who are neither seen as your senior scholars or what we call the star researchers, I think. Or they're not new scholars, they're not postdocs, but they are actually the largest core of probably most departments, most faculties, which are associate professors, or early full professors. How does mentoring matter for that group of people, especially in terms of mentoring them into full professorship? And so my view is, I think we tend to focus on the beginning and the kind of the senior end, but we miss a lot in that middle area. And then the third part of that paper, which I want to comment on briefly before the panelists, is on one size does not fit all, difference is not deficit. From that, we identified a number of kind of innovative, big thinkers, leading-edge thinkers to come and speak about the topic at the AGM. I want to present to you the panel who will be offering their wise words. They will go in this order. Adele Blackett, she is listed in the program, her bio. But briefly, she is an associate professor and William Dawson Scholar of Law at McGill, Her expertise is in labor law, trade law, and international development, and she is a member of the Equity Issues Steering Committee. Next will be Larry Chartrand, who is an associate professor of law at the University of Ottawa. He focuses on Métis studies, Aboriginal governance, but his work is also interesting because it crosses over the intersection of law and health. Our third speaker is James DeVille, who is a professor in the School for Studies in Art and Culture, Music at Carleton. He also has served as a mentor at both McMaster and Carleton, and he is really interested in and has served on committees with the Music Association of the United States on hidden disabilities. And he is also on the Equity Issues Steering Committee. We have regrets from Donna Penny, who is the Associate Dean of Arts and Humanities at the University of Western Ontario. She's a professor of Canadian Literature and the Dean of Arts, obviously. Donna sends a regret. She has been a mentor to me. She was former Vice President for Equity for the Federation, and I became much more actively involved in the Federation's work because of her, particularly at Saskatoon and then at UBC. And then I came on as vice president subsequently. So that I said as a plug that networks do matter, and how we get into those networks obviously also matter, because it helps us to see the importance of the kind of work that can be done and the possibilities and how and where we might fit in. The three speakers, Adele will speak on mentoring for cultural challenge, Larry will speak on Aboriginal mentoring, and James will speak on solving the dilemma of the SWM, which he'll explain to you, but from traditional mentoring to mentoring networks. Now, if I can briefly, mindful of the time, because we want to give as much opportunity for questions as possible, I just briefly want to comment on some of the themes that they will be pulling from, which came from that paper I offered as a discussion paper, and that's One Size Does Not Fit All. And one of them, I briefly say this. One of the biggest challenges to mentoring, especially in the context of equity and diversity, is overcoming the view that difference is synonymous with deficit, which leads to mentoring being conceived as a program to correct that perceived deficiencies of equity-seeking groups. The other issue is that there's a legacy in the history of mentoring, the expectations embedded in the notion of professionalism and good management and peer attitudes all support negative judgments about the responsiveness of certain groups of people. And that often tends to be non-white, Aboriginal, earlier in the day, you would say women, and that's changing, although there are some still questions about the limits in terms of the glass ceiling. My review of the literature, but also experiences across Canada, suggested this. One, mentoring is ad hoc and uneven. While there's some consensus that it's important, there are still several problems around this. The patchwork quilt of mentoring programs suggests, first, mentoring is a good thing, but second, one-size-fits-all approach to mentoring is not desirable. There's inequity in terms of the distribution of mentoring, and there's also the thorny issues around the claim that, on the one hand, mentoring is desirable, yet universities are reluctant to offer wholesale commitment to it because good mentoring is time-consuming. So it's under-resourced, and there are few mechanisms for valuing it. The second point, then, is that the paradoxes of mentoring, which is that, first, most universities and colleges would insist that they have a commitment to equity. Increasingly, their mission statements talk about it. Yet, despite the rhetoric, small and large institutions struggle with how to accommodate difference, given the growing tendency towards standardized performance indicators that, in practice, if not in rhetoric, reinforces one-size-fits-all. Secondly, diversity discourse on the face of it celebrates difference, yet at times, divergent approaches to academic life must face the stereotype that diversity means deficit. So we don't all come into academia in the same way. And so how does the university accommodate that, including through mentoring? And one of the issues we face often is this disconnect between how we think about equity and excellence. And so I think Adele is going to speak to that. The third point quickly, and James is going to speak to this, is around gender and mentoring too, and that's also around cross-gender mentoring. How do you design mentoring programs that are attentive to difference? It's not easy and maybe contentious. first, gender mentoring is not straightforward, no pun intended. There, historically, the majority of mentors have been white men, and this experience informs a great deal of the literature on it. As women have climbed up the ladder, the literature has started to address some of the differences. What it reveals, I think, is very interesting. First, women in senior positions does not mean that junior women will have access to them for all kinds of reasons. As there are few of these women in senior positions, they are trying to fulfill and succeed, do well at those functions. Secondly, the literature refers to as the queen bee syndrome. I'm from the Bahamas originally. All the women are known as queen bees, so apparently in Canada there are only a few of them, in which senior women forego mentoring junior women because they had to make it the hard way, so that means they had fewer advantages, so then everyone else has to kind of take their lumps and get along with it. And so there's a question about how you shift from sabotage to support. Thirdly, there are barriers based on gender differences, and women often lack access to informal mentors. Fourthly, inadequate studies have been done on cross-gender mentoring, but the literature does suggest that the women are not always credited with mentoring. They often don't recognize themselves as actually being mentors, and so on and forth. Diversity mentoring, then, is my the fourth thing I looked at. And here, again, I raise this issue of, I mean, diversity is a contested concept, but understanding difference and diversity as deficit is also a huge problem. Much of the literature on diversity is by the business schools that say diversity makes good business sense, but we haven't done a lot of that kind of thinking within the social sciences and humanities, and this panel obviously aims to do that. And then finally, a couple other points. There's a potential for conflict, and we actually need to think about what kinds of mechanisms are in place to deal with conflict when it arises in the context of mentoring. Because if you're mentoring a junior scholar, for example, or a senior person, an untenured person, that could have long-term career ramifications. And the ad hoc and informal programs often haven't given much attention to how do you deal with conflict, especially since we assume people can mentor without providing training or for them. And so that gets me to my other point, which is the unacknowledged risk of mentoring that I can talk to more, and the impact for the mentee in particular. And finally, the double-edged sword of mentoring. Academic mentoring programs have the potential to cultivate what I call the ideal academic type, one who conforms uncritically and reproduces prevailing institutional expectations. One concern with formal mentoring programs is that they aim to produce what universities see as an ideal academic, rather to foster kind of a diversity of ways of being within the academy. So we need to be attentive that we're not producing clones, or that we are not producing people who are conformists to kind of institutional one-size-fits-all institutional expectations. So with that kind of discussion paper, the panelists were invited to take whatever angle they wanted to, and they will, and like you, I will be delighted to hear what they have to say. So without further ado, let me invite to the stage Adele Blackett. Are you going to stay there?
Thank you very much, Melinda. If you don't mind, if you can hear me clearly, then... No? Okay. Is that any better? Otherwise, I'll just stand. Yes? So first, it's a pleasure to have been invited to share with you some of the thinking I've been doing on the topic of mentoring, and in particular, mentoring as a cultural pluralist approach to equity and diversity. So I thank VP Equity Melinda Smith for the invitation, as well as, I can't but mention it, the real skill and energy and devotion that she's put into the equity mandate of our subcommittee at FedCan. So my starting point is that the institution of mentoring, when taken seriously and on its own terms, that is an informal mechanism that combines and marshals the institution of personal friendship across an experiential divide to foster the professional advancement of a more senior insider to a more junior newcomer, destabilizes starting assumptions of pure abstract meritocratic fundamentalism, as some have coined it, that are at the heart of how educational and career advancement have traditionally been conceived. And if we uncover some of the issues of formalization that mentorship may mask, we have an opportunity to think about mentoring as a way to acknowledge privilege and use it purposively to arrive at cultural change that actually promotes diversity. Let me start with a particularly stark example of the contradiction between meritocratic purity and mentoring that, frankly, you're likely to find objectionable in the explicit use of mentoring to prevent diversity in the legal profession from 1902 through 1935, from an article about Mr. Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes and his relationship to his law clerks. So, and I'm basing this on an academic study by legal historian Scott Messenger. During Holmes's time as an associate justice to the United States Supreme Court, Holmes actively mentored exclusively unmarried, primarily white, Anglo-Saxon, Protestant male law clerks from only the most prestigious academic institutions in an attempt actively to safeguard the law as a preserve for elite gentlemen in the face of what at the time was the growing diversification of the legal profession. Legal education was being professionalized, apprenticeships were declining, and the door for the was ever so slightly being opened to women, to men of, quote, lesser pedigree, and, again, ever so slightly, to men of different races. So according to Messenger, Holmes used mentoring not as a gesture of mere friendship, but as a political act meant to contribute to the betterment of his society by raising lawyers, by training lawyers, by fostering lawyers who would hold what he considered to be a particularly heroic and, perhaps interestingly in these times, an anti-materialistic vision of his profession. Now, of course, this example smacks of the old boys' network and the exclusionary purposes that it served. The example also acts, though, as a cautionary note to any wholesale call to reify mentoring as an institution. With due regard to historical context, though, it remains fair to note that the gulf between the mentoring relationship and the ideology of colorblind meritocratic fundamentalism that pervades some modern approaches to employment equity is called in question. It draws on a component of mentoring that remains occluded, that mentors tend to mentor those who remind them of themselves. There is a reproductive character to the relationship of the mentor to the protege or mentee that fosters the perpetuation of the mentor's vision of the workplace, and more particularly of the workplace culture. The relation reproduces itself, and in this regard may foster academic renewal, but not necessarily cultural change. Indeed, quite the opposite of diversity. Now, contrast this example with an arguably more compelling and more contemporary, in any event, tribute by Dame Rosalind Higgins, leading international law scholar, former president of the International Court of Justice, and first female judge to have been appointed to the ICJ. And Higgins writes in tribute to her mentor, leading Yale Policy Science School academic Myers McDougall. And she writes, "Myers McDougall was a white male and from a Southern Methodist background, hardly a minority icon and certainly not an endangered species. But he was our mentor as well as our teacher. By some magical process, you could over 12 or more months have metamorphosed from a baffled newcomer to someone thought by McDougal to have promise. And then his support as mentor knew no bounds. Mac would write references more generous than one could hope for, go to extraordinary trouble to advance one's cause. All of this often went on unseen and unsolicited. We had moved without fanfare from student to friend. This tribute is, of course, very moving, and it is hard to challenge what an able and deserving protege Dame Rosalind Higgins has turned out to be. But to what extent is the McDougal example different from the Holmes example? Is the privileging that is at the center of this example more palatable because it promotes a member of historically disadvantaged groups? Certainly, there is mentoring across gender and religious or ethnic origin, as Judge Higgins is of Jewish heritage, a form of mentoring the other. What does this example do to our understanding of merit? Certainly, it suggests that merit is constructed over time through opportunity to learn and to gain guidance from a more experienced, more established member of one's academic community. But it's also, frankly, honestly, a recognition of the very present helping hand that creates opportunities for the protected ones in communities like academia, where reputational value is cardinal. The focus on cultural change turns our attention very much to how merit is reconstructed, both in graduate admissions and hiring practices in academia, as well as in the day-to-day acclimatization and performance, and that over time. And I underscore the comments made by Melinda Smith about mid-career academics as well as senior academics. Mentoring, understood as an active dynamic process, seeks to capture how merit gets reframed from within an institutional context. It recognizes that merit is nurtured. How it is nurtured is, of course, central to understanding mentoring that, frankly, formalization processes may mask. To be effective, mentoring marshals the personal, it marshals the private, and it puts them to effect in the public career achievement of the mentee. And in this regard, it butts up against, but may not necessarily foster, the objectives of workplace democratization and diversification. In rendering the public and private, personal and political more mixed, I think we do well to think of mentoring as more of a continuum rather than a juxtaposition of opposites, and this in the formal and in acknowledging the informal. So if we acknowledge that the impacts of mentoring are real, what happens if a pool of meritorious candidates comes forward for an academic post, and we prefer those candidates who are effectively mentored via informal means? Is this an equity concern? And what are the implications of suggesting that the mentoring of racialized minorities is chiefly the responsibility of those members of the same historically marginalized communities who themselves are underrepresented in academia and likely themselves to have had fewer mentoring opportunities? So if mentoring is thought of in terms of access to justice, I would contend that we need to think about mentoring in terms of recognizing and purposively acting upon existing privilege. Mentoring moving beyond getting through the door, but also developing and sustaining academic vocations and effecting or arriving at cultural change. So this then puts squarely the question of whether and how mentoring can be used as a transformative tool rather than merely an assimilative tool, as an embodied relationship that leaves space for dialogue and learning from the other rather than mere reproduction of the self. Mentoring entails building relationships across differentials in age, experience, and power. It seeks to expand life options and career advancements. Gains for the mentor are often more in the nature of their legacy, though the risk of mentorship is deeply assimilative rather than transformative remains quite potent. And it becomes, in this regard, and there's certainly much of the literature points in this direction, becomes compelling to seek to circumscribe mentoring rather than expanding its sphere. So coming back to the formalization of mentoring processes and the guidelines that ideally entail some level of cross-cultural training for mentors, mentoring becoming simply showing a junior colleague the ropes, as some have argued, may be rendered less problematic than the broader, fuller understanding of mentoring that characterizes many of the informal relationships. As my colleague will speak to, James DeVille, the emphasis on mentoring not as a solitary experience, but as an experience best understood in terms of networks, captures some of the thinking on how to imagine mentoring as being transformed. But what I want to contend in respect, in particular, of the claims that somehow a formalized, circumscribed mentoring can displace informal mentoring mechanisms and some of the concerns that then surround it, is that ultimately, if we're thinking about mentoring in terms of cultural pluralism, in terms of a vision that includes diversity, then we need to think about the formal structures as fostering or resembling access to justice, and thinking about how the informality remains, how the status quo relationships may remain and may continue unchallenged unless we think ultimately about how mentoring the other imagines rethinking the status quo. So what does it really mean to take a junior colleague from an underrepresented racial group as a protected one whose progress is nurtured over time in a workplace environment? I would suggest that a starting point is with those who know and are willing to give tribute, like Dame Rosalind Higgins, and more importantly, those who also feel a certain level of alienation, frankly, in the relation to the hard-earned but highly privileged status that they now occupy. This kind of self-reflective academic is likely to find mentoring that is conscious of other historical and persistent workplace exclusions, notably on the basis of race, to be an active way to come to terms with their own privilege and their largely inherited or certainly previously nurtured ways of being in the world. In other words, mentoring the other may be a way for members of dominant societal groups in academia to be more candid about their, our, privilege and assume a critical stance toward that privilege precisely in sharing that privilege with others. If this shared access is truly transformative, then it will move us beyond a narrow vision of merit and into an area where we can think about cultural change in academia. So I'll end just briefly with a comment on a reaction that I received when I presented this paper for the first time at a conference in London. I expected a certain amount of disavowal from those from majority cultures and with greater experience in academia. But one of the first comments that I received from a senior, well-respected male academic was that he was struck that I spoke about having a mentor, for he had had many. Right? That had been his experience of mentoring in academia. And interestingly, hopefully realistically, this is precisely the way that much of the emphasis on mentoring is turning. But I think we do well to recall it, to what extent members of historically marginalized communities would simply be delighted to find just one mentor. So let me end just by saying that mentoring has potential, certainly as a vehicle of renewal. Our inquiry, of course, needs to be not only in renewal, but also in retention, and as the focus of my paper has been, on cultural change. And its success is likely to have a great deal to do with the degree of buy-in from those best placed to mentor, who likely already do mentor in the informal manner, but whose willingness and ability to mentor the other is really at the heart of the inquiry. So I suggest that we need to look here and look honestly, carefully, and critically. Thank you.
Hello. Kwe is Algonquin for hello. Usually when I speak, it's customary for me to acknowledge the territory in which the presentation is being given. So I'd like to acknowledge the Algonquin Nation and the fact that the Algonquin Nation is unsurrendered sovereign territory. And that's an important piece of knowledge to understand, is that we're actually privileged to be here, not because we've been asked or invited by the Algonquin people. Mm-hmm. We're here because of the force of colonization, despite their existence as a nation on this territory. So I always like to acknowledge that when I present. It's interesting, too, the topic of today's talk about mentoring. There's been references to anti-assimilation or assimilative type of mentoring. And I actually labeled the topic of my talk today as anti-assimilation academic mentoring. Mm-hmm. One of the things I wanted to say, excuse my voice seems to be a little rough today. As an institution or as an individual mentor, assisting Aboriginal students or junior Aboriginal professors is what I want to focus on. We need to be as sensitive to the larger Aboriginal Canadian political, social, and legal relationship. You can't mentor without understanding the context in which the Aboriginal student finds themselves in today, or the junior Aboriginal professor. When I started myself in the legal profession, when I entered academia for the first time in 1990, there maybe was one or two other Aboriginal profs in the legal profession in the country. When I was tenured in 2001, 2002, I can't actually remember, I was the first Métis law professor ever tenured in the country. So it's hard to benefit from mentorship when there really isn't anybody out there that you can identify with and has gone through the experiences that you're about to go through. I wish I did. And I have benefited maybe informally from time to time, but I never had a mentor that kind of could identify with the issues and concerns I was I was going through, except for some peers that were coming along. But one of the things I wanted to talk about was how at one time it was sufficient, as Adele mentioned, to assist Aboriginal students to become successful in academia or in the law profession. But that assistance was designed in a way to assimilate them, to make them look more like the Canadian, your Canadian mainstream, and to, at the same time, reduce their own identity as Ojibwe or Algonquin. And, you know, it was largely perceived as a disadvantage coming in if you're Aboriginal, and that mentoring would be one means of helping that person address those disadvantages. And so mentoring very much had an assimilative impact. It was a very unbalanced kind of one-way street. You know, we can help you be successful, but you can't introduce, for example, some of your cultural teachings when you're trying to talk about torts. You know, everybody else is going to look at you funny. So that's the kind of thing that students face early on. It's interesting to note, though, that in the field of law, and like other fields like health, politics, philosophy, and even the humanities now, there's a growing recognition that Canadian academic institutions have been critically ignorant of Indigenous knowledge. See, the point I want to make is to be a mentor of an Aboriginal student or a junior professor, you not only have to be a mentor, you have to be an activist. It's a double package. You can't just mentor. If we were to look at it and perform a general scan of academia, one would see glimpses here and there, sometimes at the fringes, of attempts to include the Indigenous perspective or Indigenous knowledge, Indigenous worldviews in our fields of education. These efforts may be more prominent in some fields as opposed to others, but taken as a whole, they represent a general trend, and a very positive general trend in a certain direction. The introduction of Indigenous perspectives in mainstream curricula, the development of Indigenous law courses, where you teach Algonquin law, not just Canadian law, not just civil law, not just common law. There are little bits of that happening throughout the country. In the health profession, Indigenous knowledge regarding health and medicine, philosophy, the Indigenous perspective of understanding the world, these are starting to become more and more a part of academia. But we're in a transitional stage, and those are very minor developments when you think about the overall institutions. But they do represent one important thought. They represent the principle, when these efforts are undertaken, that Indigenous knowledges are not inferior to Western science and social thought. And that can be an extremely positive environment. If an Aboriginal student comes into law school, for example, and they see that, it's the institution is actually making a bit of an effort to address their difference in a positive way. They can identify with it, and they won't feel so alienated as many Aboriginal students are today. So one of the biggest jobs I have, or one of the things I often do with Aboriginal students, mostly on an informal basis, is to try to cope with that alienation. Because Aboriginal students generally are a small group. In law schools, for example, they may be 4 or 5 per year, if that. And there's not a lot of other colleagues for them to identify with. And then they can feel quite alienated. When institutions show an effort, though, to address the indigenous perspective, that alienation tends to be lessened. And now, one of the mentoring Aboriginal law students in today's society, you know, means means helping them cope with the reality, though, that the reverse image of their identity as Ojibwe or Algonquin, for example, in the mirror of the law school is still very faint, even though there are some of the efforts around the sides. When they look at the mirror in the law school, their identity as Ojibwe or Algonquin is very faint still. So we can, as mentors, try to address that. Because law school is still very much overwhelmingly colonial. It doesn't have a lot of the indigenous legal understandings as part of that training. So there is. So I kind of want to spend a minute or two now then just thinking about what can we do more of in terms of mentoring Aboriginal students so they can identify with the institution in a more positive way and promote their success. One of the things that does that is that there is a pre-law program in Saskatoon. Because Aboriginal students as a pool of students going into law school are generally academically not very strong. So there are efforts by the law schools to promote a greater pool by helping them develop some of the skills in the summer prior to entering into law school. And there's a strong mentoring component to that. And so students can come in a bit with a little bit of that disadvantage addressed. In fact, in 1986, I went through the summer program myself. And if it wasn't for the summer program, I wouldn't be a law professor today. That helped immensely. The other thing is we can, as I mentioned, incorporate more indigenous knowledge in our courses and in our curriculum. And in the law school, one of the most important and most recent developments, I think, is the actual beginnings of teaching indigenous law. Not Canadian law about Aboriginal people's rights, but actually teaching Algonquin law, Anishinaabe law, Haudenosaunee law. This is the second year I've done that now. I've taught a course for first-year students in those legal traditions. And you'd be amazed that, you know, of the five law students in that class, how powerful it is for them to experience that and to have their colleagues, the non-Aboriginal students in the class, accept the validity of Indigenous law as a third source of law in the country. Canadians have always thought of Canada as a bi-juridical, bilingual country. It's really a multi-juridical, multilingual country. And as institutions, we need to accept that. So that's one way that's very important in terms of mentoring. The other thing is, you know, we got to be more inclusive of Aboriginal elders in our institutions in real meaningful ways. They have a lot of knowledge and a lot of teaching they can provide, especially for the Aboriginal students, so that they don't feel so alienated. They themselves can be extremely strong mentors for Aboriginal students. If we can institutionalize more elder participation as teachers or as facilitators or guides, that would help a lot. I do that. I incorporate elders in my classroom teaching. In fact, my last class, Elder Peter DeConte, Sacred Firekeeper for the Algonquin Nation, came and spoke about his experiences with the law and how his Algonquin law came into conflict with Canadian law one day when he tried to access some territory, which he was prevented from doing so. That's traditional to his community, and was charged with trespassing. And he just wanted to conduct some important Algonquin protocols with respect to the land. So that can be very beneficial for students to see that kind of teaching from an elder, and be a mentor in that regard. Oh, and methodology too. Indigenous methodology would also help. Think about how you teach. Can you adopt a methodology that's more consistent with the Aboriginal perspective, like circle sentencing? talking circles, for example, where students sit in a circle and you undertake the Aboriginal protocol of responding to questions for discussion, where each student in turn has to respond and the other students have to pay attention and nobody can interrupt, not even the professor. The professor is just one person equal to the students in that dynamic. And you'd be surprised how powerful of an experience that is for the Aboriginal students in terms of how they can identify with the law school experience now. So that's another way. So I really don't have anything else to say other than we need to think of mentoring still in our institutions as an activist endeavor as well. We gotta include Indigenous knowledge in academia as equal to the Western scientific thought that predominates. That's the most important thing, I think, in terms of Aboriginal students being able to identify with institutions. And then if, as mentors, if we can assist in doing that, we've achieved a lot in terms of helping them succeed. So thank you.
Well, my special thanks to Melinda Smith, whose vision and energy have really propelled the steering committee into what we'd have to consider fruitful activism. She's quite a fireball, and we can't help. It's contagious, although some of us are a bit slow catching on to the contagion, but she's been a model for us all, and thank you for putting this panel together. Now, my title, Solving the Dilemma of the SWM, from Traditional Mentoring to Mentoring Networks, when I look around, I think a lot of us fall into that category of SWM, that is, senior white males. And so I'm addressing this to you, but also as, I guess, somewhat reflective of my own experience and how I indirectly came across mentoring networks. So I received my first tenure track appointment in 1988 at McMaster and promoted to associate professor in 1994. I taught in the music program there until 2005 when I took up a position at Carleton, where I attained the rank of full professor last year. My own mentorship consisted of a troubling personal relationship under the department chair at the time, that is at McMaster, who introduced me to post-secondary academe through paranoid observations and advice, provided in a host of settings from his office to his boat, from the telephone to the developing internet. Maybe some of you have had similar looking for seashells or whatever with your mentor, just to pick up on today's topic. In retrospect, I can recognize that he was that he was using me to consolidate his own power base in the unit. But in the first year, it was the only friendship I had at the university and the only official mentoring I was to receive through my home academic unit. That the quote-unquote friendship had developed into a type of codependence became apparent the next year through the shock and disappointment I experienced upon hearing of the chair's intention not to stand for a second term. This unsettling relationship illustrated to me the problems inherent in the traditional model of top-down one-to-one mentoring. Fortunately, I was already well situated within an international research community that provided at least one support in my own incipient networking, mentoring network, which would develop in the ensuing years to include departmental and faculty, capital F, colleagues, and associates in the Canadian Learned Society for Music. That I had to develop this set of relationships, this network on my own, typified attitudes of the time towards mentoring. Within 5 years of initial appointment, I became chair of the Department of Music, which thrust me into the role of responsibility for new hires. It was then that I discovered, to my dismay, not only was I expected to serve as sole mentor to them, but I also had to work against a faction that did not want to see the new colleague succeed. And such, unfortunately, may be the way it is in some departments even today. Such an attitude can deleteriously impact any fresh hire. However, I found a particularly pernicious resentment towards new women colleagues among the old boys of the department, which necessitated both vigilance and, unfortunately, strife. Subsequently, I returned to the role of formal mentor when I became director of the School for the Arts at McMaster in 1999, while at other times I mentored informally as a senior or more senior member within departmental faculty cohorts there and at Carleton. The progress of my career through the traditional academic hurdles took place at the same time as the increasing efforts of universities and hiring committees to attempt to redress historical imbalances in gender and race among the professorate. This means that I found myself mentoring, above all, young women colleagues who were the primary new hires in music at McMaster and now at Carleton. The recent literature about mentoring, and also our common sense, tells us that such relationships are fraught with problems for various reasons, not least because of the disparity of power and its potential for abuse. However, herein lies the difficulty in developing appropriate mentoring relationships. A department may not have any senior women faculty, or if it does, those few are in such demand to serve on a variety of administrative committees, at least in part for purposes of equity, that they have no time or energy to mentor. Moreover, according to the Queen Bee Syndrome, as we heard earlier, certain veteran women colleagues believe that the younger generation of women must struggle and succeed on their own, as they themselves did. Well, what can be done by senior white males, such as myself, who wish to participate in a solution? I would be happy to encourage women colleagues to mentor other women, except that in my departments they have been too junior to be put in that position. I could free those colleagues from other committee responsibilities so that they can focus on mentoring, except then the question of representation on committees arises. Is it simply a matter of time until we achieve gender parity and have multiple senior women colleagues within departments like mine? Or is there something that senior male faculty members like me can do to ameliorate the situation? This is the dilemma facing senior male colleagues who may be sensitive to issues of mentoring, representation, and power. It stands to reason that the same set of problems attaches to the mentoring of other quote-unquote designated groups in academe, whether people of color, Aboriginals, or the disabled. Only we are much further away from anything resembling hiring equity with those others. And I should note that I've never had the opportunity to mentor a music colleague from a quote-unquote designated group other than women. In other words, they are the women are the only are the only designated group that has been hired, in my experience. Given the difficulties indicated above, it seems clear that serious problems attend to the traditional method of mentoring, which is described in a recent study by Mary Dean Sorcinelli and Jung Yun as, quote, the top-down, one-on-one relationship in which an experienced faculty member guides and supports the career development of a new or early career colleague, end quote. However, in the last decade or so, there has been a proliferation of studies that examine alternatives to that model, primarily focusing on the development of networks through multiple mentoring partners in, quote, non-hierarchical, collaborative, cross-cultural partnerships to address specific areas of faculty activity, end quote, to cite Sorcinelli and Yun. These studies begin to empirically establish the value of such networks. For example, in a 2000 investigation of mentoring that involved 430 faculty members, Joy Van Eck Peluchet and Sandy Joncar determined that, quote, assistant professors with multiple sources of mentors yielded significantly higher levels of both objective and subjective career success than did those with single sources or no mentor, end quote. Suzanne DeJanas and Sherry Sullivan argued in 2005 how, quote, multiple mentors of the moment, that's their term, who can give specialized advice related to specific areas, aspects of research, teaching, service, and administration, quote, will be better able to respond to the varied and changing needs of the protégés' careers than could a traditional dissertation advisor slash mentor, end of quote. In a 2005 study by Jean Gierves, Yolanda Lepeda, and Judith Guathme, entitled, quote, entitled Mentoring in a Post-Affirmative Action World, examines mentoring from a multicultural perspective, noting how network models are more inclusive of women and racial others than the traditional grooming model. When I heard about mentoring networks, I realized that there was at least a partial solution to the dilemma in which I found myself vis-a-vis my junior colleagues, a model towards which I had been naturally gravitating since my arrival at Carleton. For example, since I've had good success with Shirk Standard Research Grants, I found myself advising new hires in this area of specialized competence. Moreover, my track record in having conference proposals accepted was also quite good, to the extent that I could review paper abstracts by junior colleagues in musicology with some confidence. Thus, I've been able to provide mentoring assistance to new women colleagues in these specific areas of professional expertise without needing to feel responsible for their overall career progress. A network of specialists like myself for research and of other colleagues for issues in teaching, administration, and academic life in general furnishes an excellent set of mentoring resources for the new hire. But where should the responsibility for developing such networks reside? Yanaz and Sullivan place the onus on the individual mentee. I find that approach fraught with difficulties, however, not the least of which being the unfamiliarity of new faculty members with their institution's resources in terms of people and programs. In contrast, Gierve, Lepeda, and Guathme suggest the need for a structural framework for mentoring networks, to which end they charge administrators with encouraging the development of mentoring programs and with ensuring that faculty members become aware of these networks' value. That may be easier said than done in the current climate of greater downloading of responsibilities to the level of the academic unit. And yet, it is imperative for purposes of equity and for faculty renewal in general that such networks not be haphazard or arbitrary, but rather built around a core of advisory competencies. While the chair or director should make certain that the new faculty member is receiving mentoring in the crucial areas of research, teaching, and to a lesser extent, service through various resources, the real impetus must come from the top. The consulted literature uniformly argues that mentoring must be a priority for upper-level administration for it to be most effective. And as former chair and director, I would have greatly benefited from such support and recognition. Mentoring networks will not solve all problems of equity for new faculty, are not without challenges of their own, but they do provide an alternative to the problematic model of top-down mentoring. As a senior male faculty member, SMW, I embrace their potential for junior colleagues, especially those who have been historically disadvantaged by traditional approaches to mentoring. Thank you.
So we have time for a fair bit of questions. Please use the microphones and direct them to panelists.
Thank you for the presentation. I'd like to take off my association hat for a moment and speak as someone who recently completed a PhD and had the fortune of mentorship from several people and different kinds of mentorship. And as you were all speaking, there's something that you touched on that a colleague of mine, right before I finished my PhD, we were talking about mentorship, and he said that his view, and he's a relatively new member of the Academy, and he said that he had finished maybe 5 years ago. And he said that in his experience of mentorship, the best ones for him were ones that were a kind of exchange where there was recognition not only of what the mentor could bring to the mentee, but recognition from the mentor that the mentee also had something valuable to bring and perspective to bring. And perhaps that resonated with me. He and I both had done our PhDs in education, where there's for a long time been this kind of question about what the teacher can learn from the person that they're teaching. And so I'm just wondering if there's any response that you might have to that.
Adele, that was part of your presentation.
So thank you for that comment, and I do think that your reflections capture certainly a form of mentorship that is not unidirectional, that is seeks also not to create a cloning effect, right? That mm-hmm. is a little more transformative in its approach. So that resonates with me. I do think, though, despite efforts to reimagine the relationship, you're still looking fairly squarely at disparities in power, right? And that have a different impact on the career trajectory of the mentee than of the mentor. And so we need to keep our eye on that ball in imagining the relationship as a vehicle to promote academic renewal and retention.
Okay. Speak ahead, sorry.
Just I was just going to say that in our small area of music, we also chat. I mean, there isn't necessarily a distinction between junior and senior, mm-hmm. yet I guess as an advisor or whatever, am well aware of the career implications for the advice that I give for someone who's untenured versus someone who has tenure, you know, because I do think that makes a difference and there is power embedded in this relationship, as Adele was saying.
Okay, my intervention is with Larry. Bonjour, Larry. I have maybe three observations about the mentoring of Aboriginal students. I am the chairholder of Canada Research Chair on Métis Identity. And in St. Boniface College, we have 11% of Métis students. It's the highest rate of Aboriginal people in a university in Canada. After is Glendon and Vancouver. And after the meeting with Lloyd at Worksley at the University of Winnipeg, when they said we have the highest rate, I said this to the president of the university at St. Boniface College. When I said this, she looked at me and said, so they don't have the same socioeconomic status of other Métis. I said, so what? They are not real Métis because they are not poor. But the things are changing. Since 2 months, we have a Métis flag in the hall of St. Boniface College. The second point, I work with the church on an Aboriginal research pilot program. The first year, we saw only, in 2004, I think, we saw only some anthropologists go fishing in Aboriginal communities to have the grant. The second competition, things come to change. Aboriginal communities know about the program and try to put some pressure on researchers. But this year, I said, where are the program in economy, education, social service, where the people need research made about and with them? Last year's very interesting. It's nearly it's just Aboriginal communities who have the project and they go fishing, anthropologists and researchers to do the job. It's very interesting. And the last point, the last day of the church competition on the Aboriginal research pilot program, we have a discussion and the church asks us what we can do for Aboriginal student. Because in this program, you have an obligation to have Aboriginal student and undergraduate and graduate to work on the program. And I said, I propose a program which work with mentoring with Aboriginal student. I think with a good mentoring, we can develop maybe a strong leadership in this community, or some people can be a leader for the other one. And it's just my impression. Thank you.
I guess that was more of a comment about some of your initiatives, and I certainly appreciate that. Can I just answer the last question briefly? I was reflecting on my recent experience with this new group in that formed in Vancouver. We had a meeting called the Indigenous Legal Pedagogies meeting. It was a meeting of all the Aboriginal law profs in Canada, which was about 9 or 10 of us, which, by the way, is quite a lot, considering that there weren't that many when I started, maybe 3 or 4. What I found there was there was a lot of junior Aboriginal law profs or students just in the graduating from their master's or doctoral programs that were there who were Aboriginal. And the session actually became a mentoring session, informally over lunch. Some of us have more experience, and we helped talk with them about, well, how many publications do you need to, get tenure, and what do you have to do to get SHRC funding? And that, I thought, was quite a valuable experience. But you can't have that in our individual institutions, because there's just not enough of us. But when we had that opportunity, when we were all together, it happened. So I just wanted to comment on that.
Okay, thanks. So comment in front, then comment in back. Okay.
Thanks. First of all, an anecdotal story, and then secondly, I have a question. But first of all, thank you for what you've said, and to Melinda for organizing this. this is an important and stimulating discussion. I am the first woman and the first Jew to be hired in my department of religion at Bishop's University, and I was fortunate in having many mentors, actually, but it came about in a very informal way, sort of in the way that Adele was speaking. Little did I know that I would find my mentors among the circuit workout group that I was asked to join. I was the second woman, and there were eight men, and we would meet twice a week in the gym to work out, go running. And initially, I did feel quite alone, but as I got to know these people as friends, we'd be running along, and I'd ask questions. I'd pose questions about issues that had come up in classes, and I had a wealth of wisdom and advice to draw on. So I don't know if these men know that they were my mentors, but I think I'm going to go back and tell them this, because they are. My second, or my question, is that we've been speaking a lot about diversity, and that, of course, is important, and particularly in academic organizations, to reflect, as Melinda was saying, the diversity that we have in our country. And as we look around the room, we're very much a wall of white. I wondered if you had any advice, concrete sort of action that could be taken by representatives of universities and associations to get more people involved from the historically marginalized people. And so thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks very much for that, both the anecdote and the question. And on the question, I'll just start us off. But I think certainly my starting point has been that there are formal mechanisms in place, some of them increasingly tested, and they offer an opportunity from the top down for institutions to acknowledge the role that mentorship plays. And to put in place programs that that assist for mentorship relationships to develop. And I very much like the direction that James's research takes those initiatives in, although I will express a concern that mentorship not be I'll say reduced, but to the realm of simple guidance on a sporadic basis, right? I think we really are looking at relationships over time that one can count on, right? For a range of questions, and a risk of dispersal of responsibilities is ultimately that there isn't actually somebody assuming the responsibility to be present when asked, when needed. So the formalization certainly has a role. My concern, though, is that formalization, one, won't supplant informal mechanisms, and two, may lead us to underestimate the impact of informal approaches and their continuing role in privileging those who already have greater access to academia. Right? So I think for institutions to look closely, to acknowledge and to look closely at informal practices and think about, one, circumscribing some of the impacts of those informal practices through attention to what we value in a candidate, how we expect the candidate's profile to come forward. Something is as simple as valuing too highly the candidate who has a considerable amount of insider knowledge about how a community functions, right? How a particular department or faculty functions, as opposed to someone who might come in looking a lot more green because they haven't had access to a lot of information about how that department functions, but does have or show promise, right? And how we think about that across lines of diversity becomes important. So recognizing the informal and then recognizing and giving space for merit to be constructed over time. And in relation to this, I think ultimately we can look from the top and look at what concretely institutions can do, but we also do have to create spaces where we're calling upon each other as colleagues to think about what we do as informal mentors.
Okay. James?
Talking about hiring does take us a little bit off topic, and yet I have to say that at Carleton I was on the one hand impressed that I don't know how widespread the practice is that we, every time a hire takes place, a person from Equity Services needs to brief or debrief the committee, and we have a handbook. However, in the case of a recent hire in music, this happened after the after we had already screened the applicants. And of course, that needs to be taken much earlier, and encouraging us to be more proactive in finding eligible candidates from designated groups and all, because that does take time, and that is an investment of time and effort. While there are mechanisms, it seems as if they don't work in practice as well as they should.
I just want to make a comment, and because Donna Penny had sent along some comments, and I think it's pertinent if I can just raise them here. One of the things that she had said would be useful is if we embedded mentoring into collective agreements.
Yes.
As a sanction process, and that we took it more seriously as part of workload agreements and annual performance evaluations, or part of tenure and promotion processes, curriculum vitae formatting, and if we developed a detailed understanding of how collective agreements define and value academic responsibility. But the dilemma she articulated with regard to individual one-on-one mentoring, whether it's whether we see it as co-mentoring both ways, or the mentor-protege formulation, is that it can become very much, mentoring one individual risk that no institutional change actually occurs. You end up, one successful person ends up mentoring another successful person, and that has the risk of cloning, rather than the kind of social or institutional change that Adele was also talking about. But certainly, if we take Larry's comments about the kind of who would be available to do that kind of stuff, it seems to me we need to be imagining different types of mentoring relationships, and which raises questions about then how do we incorporate that within the institutions in which we work, where, I mean, time is a precious resource, and certainly, we have more and more on our plates that goes unrecognized, certainly undervalued. But I think this is a thorny question from an institutional point of view that needs to be addressed. So I'll take the next question back there.
Thanks. My name is Bud Hall. I'm from the University of Victoria. Thanks so much for organizing the panel. It's very, very stimulating and much appreciated. And thank you very much for acknowledging the territory. It's something that we do in BC, and it does remind us where we are. This is an extremely important conversation, and it links to the conversation from the president about where the social sciences are in Canada, where knowledge in society, the kind of debate that we're having, whether we like it or not, with our political folks. And I really think that we need to think about it in light of what, the last comments you were making, Melinda, and, each of you, the panelists, in that when we think about the next generation of scholars in a way that is not just reproducing the status quo, because as you've all said and we recognize, this room is a good demonstration that that's not working. And in a transformative manner. And you know, my own sense is that I'd be quite nervous about formalizing the, you know, as I think James you put it well, the senior white male, you know, or senior, you know, sort of mentoring one-on-one model into collective agreements. Mm-hmm. And I really do like the imagination that each of you are bringing about interdepartmental, multiple mentors, interinstitutional. You know, I think that we haven't mentioned that, but lots of us, David, you just mentioned about the law professors getting together. Mm-hmm. A lot of mentoring that has happened with many of us happens because we meet in our academic societies across the whole country. And I'm wondering, at our university, because of an inability to find appropriate mentoring ways in some areas, for example, amongst indigenous faculty, they've created their own indigenous faculty caucus, mm-hmm. and that caucus is now providing a space for mentoring. I'm wondering what you think about universities, or perhaps it's happening in yours, actually putting resources into some of these, you know, minority professor networks, women's caucuses historically have been useful in Canada politically, indigenous faculty caucuses where there are enough, you know, folks to make a difference, and in areas of which we're another area of excluded folks are people with various differently abled people, which we haven't talked too much about. So I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
Okay, thanks.
I do like the idea of institutions providing some sort of support for indigenous, faculty, probably at the university-wide level. There's usually not that many indigenous faculty in any one program. So it can be cross-disciplinary because there are a lot of experiences and concerns and issues that indigenous professors have that's unique, but it doesn't really mean, it doesn't depend on what discipline they're in. These are issues about, how can I justify, being indigenous, but I'm teaching the status quo and all the dilemmas around that. Those kind of opportunities would be great, I think, if universities would do that. It's done kind of informally sometimes, with the odd colleague, but it would be useful, I think, to have it more formalized.
I'll also respond a little bit to that, because I think it does raise a crucial set of concerns, institutional support for the many forms of association that members of equality-seeking communities may form is very much needed. But those communities, although they may well proliferate now, have existed over time, and they do provide support, but they the extent to which they've structurally changed representation in the academy is limited, and I'd suggest it's limited precisely because the members of those communities, even when on academia, are not positioned usually in a manner where they have the kind of systematic institutional power to be able to promote diversity more broadly. So I think it still comes back to the overwhelming majority in academia to be thinking about their role in actively promoting diversity through the time and effort and, yes, great difficulty, though not to be overstated, right? The circuit is a nice example of that. I think if we don't, as majority cultures, tackle how our everyday gestures, our everyday privileging, right, includes or excludes groups, we will be having the same conversation 10 years from now, 20 years from now, right? So it's I think that has to remain central to the discussion.
Okay, we have time for one final question. Thanks.
Thank you. This has been very useful, and useful in particular to me because I began as the only woman in a department of 30-some men and was not mentored in any formal way, learned to create informal ways for myself, but that took a good deal of effort, learned subsequently get support for my efforts, and founded an academic women's association that set up a mentoring group, among other things. But the question that has been bothering me more over the years, and at my universities there's three or four ways you can mentor, and I have my name on all of them, is how do you deal with the advice you give when, on the one hand, say, you wish to promote fairness and equity. So, for instance, this is something I've encountered twice. Young faculty woman wishes to have second baby before tenure. I start shaking all over, but I know what I'm supposed to say, which is, could you wait just a little bit? But that's not appropriate. So I say, well, of course, you will have your extra year off. That won't be counted towards tenure. But in fact, the one who did have the baby did get the extra year off, but didn't get enough publications. So it was turned down. And I now have learned from several other people that this has happened elsewhere. So what is my question? How do you balance, and I have some thoughts about this myself, but I'd be interested in it. How do you balance a commitment to being open to and present all the things that I personally have fought for so that people will have more opportunities to do it in another than straightforward, old-fashioned way, when you know that, in fact, the system can still come down pretty darn heavily if you don't? So I have one thought, but I'd like to hear others. And it comes from a comment made here, and it's something I'll look into. I think maybe having equity officers visit and talk to all advisees or potential mentors would be a good idea, and perhaps get some conversation going between mentors, because I was acting individually. Subsequently, I got anxious, talked to a number of other people, and discovered they were encountering some of these same issues, not just the one I mentioned, but similar, where you were balancing between what the formal rights were and what, in fact, the system rewarded. That's my question. Any other ideas?
Thank you. Are there?
We pass it back to the chair.
Yes. I mean, that's one of the things I think I take up as kind of the double-edged sword of mentoring. And there's another parallel to that actually in the business school, too, which is to say when women have their children, it's at precisely that moment when the salaries start to go up and the benefits start to go up. So, and if they take a year off, they will never catch up. So the pay equity gap expands exponentially in that moment. And this is why I call it the double-edged sword, is because institutions, on the one hand, provide you these benefits, but those benefits end up being deficits if, in fact, you don't ultimately get what you want and why you're there, which is tenure and promotion. And so it seems to me that the regulations suggest you can have it all. You can have, you know, maternity or parental leave, and you could have tenure and promotion. Yet if you don't continue on this trajectory, which is where you look exactly like your other peers who've been publishing madly, you know, publish or perish, then you don't get tenure and promotion. So that schizophrenia must be addressed. And my view is one of the things why we wanted to take this up and have a conversation about it is precisely so that we can think through those kind of thorny issues and questions that are often not looked at when we present the rosy picture of how good is this thing called mentoring. And Adele is going to give us a word before I offer my thanks.
Just very briefly, because your example is so compelling and so many sort of in that have dealt with precisely the question, not only the circumstance, but I'd suggest one of the things is that's so compelling about what you've said is, one, you fought for this, right? But then you're, as a mentor, being asked for more than what's on the page, right? How is this going to affect me? And I think on the one hand, you really do want to respect the equality gain, such as it is, by giving the honest answer, right? Which is that so many here's what's happened to others. Here's what I did, is what one of my female colleagues said to me, right, about the timing, and then make sure you have enough of a relationship to leave the space for choice. But the answer I really want to give is that we should not either subsume everything into the mentoring relationship as the advice between the two, but how does the mentor, in relation to that circumstance, whatever that mentee chooses, then position him or herself in the institutional structure to make sense of that choice to decision makers like tenure committees, right? To saying, guess what? Here's what the statistical data say about the impact of this choice, or here's why that extra year really is not a gift to women with young kids, right? But rather, here's why we might be thinking about when this person comes back, leaving her an extra term for research without teaching, right? So bringing that package forward in a way that the mentee cannot when she asks for tenure. So I think we are valorizing what goes into the mentorship relationship in terms of the exchange, but I think there's a lot more that goes into the relationship in terms of mediating the institutional structure.
Okay. There, just one comment. On the blog, there's an entry by Sarah Wolf and Ilsa Craig at Memorial on precisely that takes up this issue of two young women who are across the country mentoring each other, and they lay out how they do that, dealing with children, dealing with laundry, dealing with spouses, dealing with all the career expectations. And it's actually quite a powerful piece on the blog. But this brings me to the end of this plenary, and I want to make a comment that I think the equity issue portfolio sees many of these kinds of things as, again, I'm going to spiff off my brother down south, and actually there's two of them. One's no longer here. Talking about the fierce urgency of now, I don't see diversity, equity and diversity as things we can continue to put off indefinitely as kind of some kind of futurology study. We will have them down the road. The moment is here and it's now, and we are all on hiring committees, so let's get on with changing what we look like. And I'm hoping that you will be giving ideas to Noreen and to Jean-Marc about how we can make ourselves much more diverse. And so if I had a dream, the dream would be that, you know, many of us would make ourselves redundant, and that this room would look a lot different, including me. I'd like to take some time off. So anyway, but please join me in thanking our three fabulous presenters, Larry, Adele, and James, and also our live bloggers at the back. Thank you very much.
So lunch is in penthouse. It's on the 25th floor, so I advise you not to walk and take the elevator. The 26th floor, so 26th floor. The penthouse floor. Okay. And we're going to try to start as soon as possible. We're going to have the Dr. Baudet addressing us as soon as we finish lunch, so like to get this process going. Thank you.
Would you like all of our...
I would like all of them.
Because
Just
okay.
Les
ordinary
You can't. You can.